What makes the Toyota Corolla self-charging hybrid Ireland's favourite hybrid? It's time to find out. Choose the spacious Corolla Saloon, the iconic hatchback or the stunning touring sports. With incredible offers available and lower tax than diesel, now's the time to join the thousands of hybrid drivers who have made Toyota Ireland's best-selling car brand in 2021. Contact your dealer or try out our virtual tools at toyota.ie and start your electric journey today. Toyota. Built. For a better world. Terms and conditions apply. Claim applies up to March 2021.
Hello, and welcome to the Novel Traveller podcast. My name is Michelle Walsh-Jackson, and I'm the Novel Traveller. Well, my guest this week is no stranger to your airwaves, as it's journalist and broadcaster Tina Gates. Her silken tones have graced independent radio news for years, and she's also a regular panellist on The Elaine Show on Virgin Media. Tina has done some wonderful work to bring about awareness for caregivers in Ireland, as she too is main caretaker for her 93-year-old dad who suffers from ALS. But Tina has certainly been on some novel travels, which I'm sure you're going to enjoy hearing about. And I'm also going to take some time at the end of this podcast to talk about my own travel experiences, as this is the last in the series. I'm hoping to give you some insight into how I wrote my new novel, Journey to the Heartland, and just have a good old chat about why we love travel so much. So for now, sit back, relax with your glass of wine or your cup of tea, and enjoy while we go on this week's Novel Travels. Well, with me today, I have Tina Gates, journalist and broadcaster, and she's also quite a Wonder Woman as well, because you've done a lot of pioneering work for caregivers, haven't you, Tina?
Yes, I didn't choose to be an advocate for family carers, but I ended up being so because my dad is 95 and he lives with me. So I've found myself shouting quite a bit. And developing almost a kind of a movement. So
you're doing great work. And you sent me a beautiful photograph of yourself and your dad back in Tramore, back in the day when he was teaching you to swim. Is that right?
Yeah, that's actually, there's a family controversy over that one as well. It was my first trip to Ireland. It was also my first time in a plane. I was 4 years of age and the family came over from my dad had left his home in Dublin and had brought his wife and two boys over to England for a new life in England. And I was born in England a couple of months after arrival, an accident of birth. So at the age of four, he brought us all back on our first family holiday back to Ireland. And we flew into Belfast from England on the first. And it was a Viscount. So the propeller planes, I'm always fascinated because Virgin, when they relaunched in or launched in Ireland many, many years ago, they started with Viscounts, and my dad was able to show me that that was the first plane that I'd been on.
Wow. So
that was
quite...
We flew into Belfast and then he hired a car and we drove all around Ireland and we visited his relations, my mum's relations, and we did all the sites. And down in the south, we went to Tramore, and that's where dad gave me my first swimming lesson. But according to my mum, who's now passed, but my mum always said that it was actually not intended because she had a fear of water and wouldn't go anywhere near the sea. So she was sitting up on the beach screaming while she noticed my dad going for a swim, having left me on a rock. But unfortunately, the tide came in and, according to her, swept me from the rock. And she reckons that I paddled ashore. I don't know the truth of the matter.
That explains your great sense of adventure then, because you have done incredible swimming in different places and in triathlons, and you know, you're a really adventurous traveler, aren't you?
Yeah, I've been really, really lucky. That comes with a twist, really, because I have suffered and struggled with obesity all my adult life. And back in 2010, I kind of famously, or even maybe even infamously, lost 10 stone in a year. And it kind of pushed me off into a whole adventurous zone of doing things that I never thought I'd be able to do. And I started kayaking and cycling and hiking, and I found myself on some of the highest mountains in the world. I went to Everest Base Camp, and I went beyond that to Island Peak, which is the technical climb on a mountain range in the same Everest range in Nepal. I've kayaked whitewater rapids in Uganda, and I've just had and scuba diving. I did some scuba diving as well. So yeah, really. Now I'm struggling with my weight again, and I'm hoping this lockdown's been really hard for me. So I'm hoping to lose weight again this coming year, and to get back to my big aim at the moment is to get back to climb Carantool by the end of the year. So
that's not an easy feat, because I was down there about a year and a half ago, and it's a big challenge, especially that Devil's Ladder. It really is difficult. Just to go back to base camp, I mean, is it an incredible place to be, the people you're with? What is it like there? I can't imagine what Base Camp of Everest is like.
It was life-changing for me. Island Peak was life-changing for me. But we spent 3 weeks getting to Base Camp and beyond. I went with Pat Falvey, who's of course an incredible Irish adventurer, and his heart, I think, really lifted the troops as well. But we sang our way through Everest. Like, we were known as people heard us coming from miles away. We literally sang our way through, like this massive Von Trapp family.
What were you singing? Can you remember any songs you sang?
We did an incredible version of Bohemian Rhapsody in a tea house halfway up to Everest Base Camp, which I think will probably be talked about for years. But everything, even Christmas carols when we rang out of songs, we did everything. Irish ditties, rock songs. Oh, my goodness. We had, I mean, with altitude, you'd think that you would be saving your breath for putting one foot in front of the other, but actually we were stretching our lungs and singing. But it's incredibly beautiful. It's absolutely extraordinary. And being in Nepal has this sense as well of you get a crash course on what's important in life and the priorities in life, because you're meeting these people who are living in the in very scarce conditions, if you like, and children who appear to have so little, and yet they have so much, and it makes you very, very emotional, or it certainly had that effect on me. And I remember coming back home after my whole Everest adventure, and about 6 months later, a friend of mine who's a plumber was fixing a toilet for me in my ensuite, and because it wasn't flushing, and he said, "How long has that been out?" And I said, "Oh, about 6 months." He said, "Well, why didn't you call me before?" And I said, "Oh," and I said, "it worked perfectly fine. I just had to throw a bucket of water down it." And he was looking at me in complete amusement, because I was still on mountain time. Because, like, you know, the idea of having something that you could sit on and remove.
Yeah, that was a luxury.
The fact that I didn't have a flushable handle, that didn't really, you know, that didn't come into it. It was already a luxury, yeah. So, I mean, anybody who's been out in Nepal or any of, sort of the high places in the world like that, you'd be familiar with drop toilets. And in Africa, I used drop toilets, and there was no drop. Like, you know, you were literally standing on top of a drop hole. But over in the mountains, it's incredible, because you're looking down and several hundred feet underneath. It could be a very windy experience, to say the least.
I'd say, but maybe you'd be scared, and you definitely would want to go after looking down.
Oh, well, I climbed Elbrus in Russia, the Caucasus in Russia, and I remember having to have a rope tied around me as I went down to the drop toilet, because I was afraid of spinning off the end off the mountain and not coming back.
Whereabouts in Russia is that?
Mount Elbrus is one of the highest mountains in the world, and it's in the Caucasus in Russia, or I say the Kerry of Russia.
Oh, really?
And, yeah, that was an incredible place to go to. I found Russia itself extraordinary, and on that trip I went, I was in Moscow for a while as well, but I found it really freaky in my mind, because everything is so big, and you see the ruins as you drive through the countryside. You see the ruins of the incredible mechanical revolution that they had there, and you see the massive gas lines and the power. You can nearly feel the power of Russia as she was through the you know, the powerful stages of its history, and it kind of takes your breath away a little bit. But yeah, that mountain Elbrus was extraordinary. It's you can still smell the sulfur. It's volcanic, and you feel it. It's a very dramatic mountain, and it's very weather prone, and it really all depends on whether you get the weather window to manage to get the summit. And we were fortunate. Now, Pat Falvey was leading that expedition as well, and he's got an uncanny gift for seeing the window, and we got a great window. There were several trips up at the same time as us, and we were the only ones who managed to make it to the summit.
I mean, there is something about pushing yourself, isn't there, and reaching a summit like that, that helps you really see a different side of life in yourself.
Yeah, well, the biggest peak I did was Island Peak. I mentioned that was in the Everest range, and that's even higher than base camp, and that was a technical climb. So this point, and I'm literally standing on a summit which is the size of a coffee table at the top of this mountain, and it's it's over 20,305 feet, and I'll include the 5 foot because that was the hardest.
I'd say so.
The hardest. But I was standing up there and I was watching birds flying hundreds of feet down below me, and it wasn't even that I had this feeling, it was that I had this complete certainty, and it was probably oxygen deprivation, but I had this certainty that I could do anything in the world, and I just felt, you know, I kind of had this flashback to being a child and watching the Discovery Channel on TV and seeing these professional adventurers doing extraordinary things. And I suddenly realized that I had done something that extreme, and I just felt I could do anything in the world. And that feeling didn't go away for ages. I got a good, I'd say a year and a half run out of that. You know, it really sort of boosted my confidence and kind of changed the way I lived my life when I came back home. I mean, the simplicity of Nepal affected me, and I suppose the success I was after having and pushing myself beyond my own limits, that affected me in ways that changed my entire outlook on life, really, you know.
It's a brilliant achievement, and something that you probably should pat yourself on the back more and sort of kind of delve back into it and think about that, because like if I had achieved that, I'd be thinking about it all the time, I'd imagine. I'd absolutely, it's something I do have a dream to climb Kilimanjaro, even after speaking to Ruth Scott and her telling me how dreadful it was. I do absolutely love the idea.
Well, I did it. I don't think it's dreadful.
Oh, excellent. We've got another viewpoint. Brilliant. We'll have to have words with Ruth. Tell me about Kilimanjaro.
Kilimanjaro was extraordinary. And I tell you, the most magical moment for me was the actual, like obviously you spend a lot of time coming up through loads of different weather patterns and geographical changes, because as you go up the mountain, you go from, you know, this rich African vegetation to a kind of desert type appearance, and then a kind of a tundra, a frozen type experience. So you're seeing all these different places within the one mountain, but the most magical to me was the final night when we were going for the summit, and we got up in the middle of the night, because you climb when the ice is hard, you know, when the ground is frozen, it's the easiest to get traction, and particularly on that, there's a long gravel slope on the last night of climbing. So you go when it's really, really cold in the morning at around 3 o'clock. And I got up out of the tent and I climbed out of the tent, and I sort of felt nervous and apprehensive and maybe a little sick. And then out into the night, I looked, and all the way up through the rest of the peak of the mountain, stretching off into the darkness, you could see lights. And they were the lights of other climbers who were also making their way to the top of the mountain. And there was something very spiritual about it. And it was just the feeling that we were all united with these people that we didn't know, that there were hundreds of other people climbing on this mountain on this night, and we could see their headlights leading the way for us. And then we took our position in the chain and we became the headlights leading for somebody else. And I found it, and again, maybe it was the oxygen deprivation, but I found it really, really moving and very, very spiritual. And then when the hardest point for me was when the sun broke through. And normally that gives you this sense of strength on the mountain. When the sun rises, all of a sudden you get this burst of strength. But for me on Kilimanjaro, it kind of highlighted the fact that we still had so far to go. Uh-huh. And the toughest part, I think, for most people is that you talk about this scree. There's a massive scree bank that you have to climb that goes on for hours. So you're taking a foot in a step, and your foot is sliding back down like a cartoon character. You're running in one circle.
One step forward, two steps back kind of thing, you feel.
Yeah. And I had climbed, I'd stayed a week in Kropatrick in a hostel at the foot of Kropatrick. And I climbed Kropatrick three times a day for a week because they have a similar scree. So I got used to climbing Kropatrick. And when I was on that difficult point in Kilimanjaro, I told myself, you've done it on Kropatrick and you did it for a week on Kropatrick. You only have to do it for a couple of hours here. And that got me up that extra elevation. And then all of a sudden you're back up and you're seeing the remains of the ice up on the top of the mountain. And you just have possibly maybe a half a kilometre to go then to reach the that famous sign that everybody falls over.
Your photo at the top of it, did you, Tina? I hope you have that.
I was in a state of semi-collapse, I think. But yeah, I got it.
Oh, very good.
To go back, I'd love to do those things again. And you're right, I want to tap into those experiences now because I'm struggling with my weight again. So I'm using that as a way to remind me that, you know, I've allowed my world to shrink a little because of the fact that I've put on all this weight again. So I want to tap into those times.
I think because we're all struggling a little bit with this limitation and these lockdowns and this it's a form of imprisonment, really. You are imprisoned, you know, within your 5K. And it's not in the nature of people. It's in the nature of people to travel and expand. So, you know, I think the best thing we can do, like you say, is delve into ourselves and see how we can bring ourselves out of it, you know?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the end of it. I can't imagine. I mean, I will never take travel for granted again. Yeah. Oh, my God. I mean, all the times that I have said that, oh, I'd love to go such and such a place and I'd love to go such and such, and I haven't done it. That will never happen again. Give me back my planes, my trains, automobiles.
Yeah, absolutely.
Get out there and start looking at the world again. I mean, and I'll never take it for granted again. I'll always push the boat out in future.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we all will. You mentioned Uganda there. I'm just so fascinated by the places you're mentioning. And you went whitewater rafting, which I've done in Peru, and I absolutely adored it. But did you go on a long trek or what?
Yeah, we went with Concern, and it was the first multi-sport adventure trip that Concern put together. So it was all a bit experimental. It was decided, obviously, that the trip was planned ahead, but we were going to do this whitewater canoe trip down the Nile. But we decided that we would link the two with mountain biking. So we cycled for a couple of hundred kilometres across Africa and camped out as well across Uganda and camped out. And that was an extraordinary experience because we were seeing parts of the countryside that normal tourists don't get to see. So it was a really, really unique experience. And we visited schools along the way and we brought them pencils and little gifts and things from Ireland. And that was lovely. But again, it was such an unusual experience that we felt that we were traveling across ground that hadn't been done before. And, you know, you could smell the Nile on the air. It was extraordinary as we came out of the dry.
Really?
Yeah, the dry baked land of Uganda. And we'd spent about two or three nights camping out, and it would rain at 4 o'clock precisely on the dot. And we'd be cycling and we'd get soaked at 4 o'clock. And then we'd set up camp and we'd put all our wet cycling clothes over the top of the tent, and we'd get up the following morning and they'd still be wet. So you have this idea about Africa being so hot, and of course it is, but it was cold at night. Our clothes were wet going to bed, and we were getting into wet clothes at 5 o'clock in the morning to get out on the bikes before the heat of the day really cracked up. So we'd be there on our bikes in our wet cycling shorts, pushing off, feeling absolutely miserable for the first hour. And then the next month the sun would come and it would dry everything out, and we'd be off and happy again. But as we got close to the Nile, the countryside started to change and the baked dark earth started to change in colour, and you'd see more greenery, but you could literally smell the sweetness of the Nile, and you could smell the change on the air. And to me, that was extraordinary. And it was just, you know, again, it's a memorable thing for me.
Africa is the most amazing continent. It's somewhere I really want to explore more. There's something about the people and the nature, and they're so much more in tune with their land, you know. Yeah, when you got to the Nile, did you do anything?
Yeah, I was the crazy person. They said, don't cycle down the Spree into the river. That's not a good idea. So, of course, I had to. So everybody was kind of, you know, being very cagey about getting into the Nile. And to me, I was just after cycling across a large expanse of Uganda, and it was hot and dusty and dirty. And, you know, as we've already said, I have a love affair with the water. And so, as soon as I saw it, that was it. I cycled right down and jumped straight into the river, and it was just extraordinary. It was amazing. And then people started, some of my colleagues started saying, could I see snakes and could I see alligators and that kind of
fabulous
made an impression on. Fortunately, I didn't see any snakes, but yeah, it was lovely. It was great.
Well, that leads me to ask, what's your funniest thing that happened to you on holiday
in the south of France? And I was staying in a beautiful place that I hope to go back to, called Villefranche-sur-la-Mer. And
It's fabulous. It's beautiful.
You've been there.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite places in the world. And it combines, as you know, then having been there, it combines so much, because it has the luxury of Cannes and Monte Carlo all around you. And it has the fun, the party town of the city of Nice. But this is a tiny little fishing village that is tucked away between Monaco and Nice. And it's
very
actually
chic, isn't it? Very chic. Or there's something
absolutely. But the cruise ships all come in during the day, and then at night you get the village back to yourself, and it's just this magic little hideaway spot that I love, and I go to quite a lot. But the sea, of course, was calling me again, and I was uh-huh. swimming down off the beach, and they had I was after going and swimming to. I'm a long distance swimmer, so I had swum down to coves on either side of the beach, and I had learned to actually let the lifeguard know that I'd be away for quite a while, because I had previously gotten into trouble with the lifeguard because I'd gone missing on them. So he was kind of used to the fact that I would go and swim off into the distance and not appear for a long time. So on this particular occasion, I was coming back in after a long swim, and there was beautiful surf, which is unusual. It doesn't usually get that choppy there, but I was playing in the surf. I was kind of body surfing and jumping up and down at the waves. But I am of a certain age, and I'm certainly, you know, I'm carrying a little bit of weight at the time, a lot more now. But anyhow, to cut a long story short, two fishermen thought I was in difficulty, and they came to rescue me. And although I speak a little French, I wasn't quite up to explaining to them that I actually wasn't drowning, that I was just having a swim. So these two fishermen, anyhow, came and started, you know, physically lifting me up out of the water. And they were big, tall men. And I was, you know, I'm only 5 foot nothing. So there I was with my feet spinning in between them as they carried me into shore. And then I looked at them, and they were so gorgeous looking. Stop struggling. This is
exactly. That's okay. I was just about to ask you that. I said, were they nice? You know, was it kind of.
I quite enjoyed it once I relaxed and went with the flow. Like, and it was quite nice.
You should have brought them out for a drink, because they rescued you.
The only side about it was that I went to the beach the next day and they were there, so I was kind of afraid to get into the water in case they come and rescue me again. So
that's really good. That's brilliant. I can just picture that scene. if you could be anywhere in the world right now, where would you want to be?
Well, funnily enough, I'd love to be back in Villefranche-sur-Mer. That would be, you know, a very easy one for me and a very easy quick fix. But I do have on my list of places to be, and I'm sure you've been there, and that's Machu Picchu. And, you know, it was on my list, and then I put on the weight and I kind of let it slide off my list. And I'm so determined now after this lockdown that I'm going to get my fitness back, and I want to be back there. And I really want to experience Machu Picchu, and I want to experience it on horseback. I'd love to do it on horseback.
Well, I've actually been on horses in the Andes. I went around Cusco, and they do have these fabulous saddles. They're the big kind of what's the gauchos? Is that what they're called? You know, like the farmer's saddles, and they're very much like the American Western saddles that you ride when you're in America's heartland and that. And it is so comfortable. It's amazing, and the scenery is spectacular when you're up in the Andes. I could recommend it. I think that is a great idea. I got the train to Machu Picchu. I didn't do the 4-day trek. I hate to say, I'm a bit of a wuss. I was with my son, and we had our biscuits on the side of our coffee. It was kind of that sort of trek.
Very sophisticated.
Very, very nice. But you can actually walk right up from the little town to Machu Picchu. And I have to say, I think it's going to be more limited and controlled. They were starting to do that 3 years ago when I was there, but I think it's going to be even more limited. So you'll really have to plan well in ahead. But I do believe big trips like that are going to be in big demand once we do start to travel again.
Yeah, I can well appreciate that. But the way that they were bringing in those restrictions, was it to protect the environment?
Yeah, it was to protect the sites, because there were just so many tourists.
Right.
So you're being limited, you're given time slots. So I can see the rise of the travel agent, Tina, you know, coming back very much so, with people planning very well in advance, because probably around the world, you know, there will be less visitors to certain sites. So you would have to be more prepared, you know. But that's kind of a good thing for the environment too, because although, you know, they really do protect Machu Picchu is one of the seven wonders of the modern world. It really is important that, you know, it's not eroded or destroyed in any way by over tourism. So we do.
Yeah, it's very important. And in fact, you know, in all the adventures that I had, that was something that kind of leaned rather heavily on me, because you do start wondering about large groups of people on trekking trails and what damage they may be doing. And you know, you're sort of marrying the love of seeing something and experiencing something with the need to protect it and preserve it. And even in our own country, our own mountains as well, you know, we need to be looking to the future and looking at, you know, ahead and seeing how best to accommodate
planning all this. Well, what did they say? Take nothing but photos and leave nothing but footprints, you know.
And we
definitely do. Well, Tina, what's the most spectacular thing you've seen on your travels?
I think the most spectacular and the most surprising was the Northern Lights. And I travelled to Oslo with an Irish adventure company, actually, and to Oslo. And we went out beyond there to one of the most northerly peaks. And I was literally on the edge of the Bering Sea, and I was camped on a frozen lake. And I was there for a week, and I got to go by and travel by snow ski, but also sled. dog sleds.
And oh wow, dogs pulling you along.
It was absolutely amazing. And I slept under rainbow skins and ate rainbow stew. But I did get to see the Northern Lights not once, but at least four nights. They danced for me, and it was absolutely extraordinary. And I went out before, there was a couple of days where the lights were flirting with us and we didn't get to see them. And I went out at night with snowshoes on when everybody else was sleeping. And I was tramping across the hills in the snow with my snowshoes and just taking in the scenery and taking in the cold iciness of this wonderful, wonderful place. But on the night that they actually did show up, they showed up so incredibly. And the thing that fascinated me the most was you could still see the moon and the stars through them. Sort of imagined when I looked at pictures and videos that they were, you know, a block of color, but it was more almost enchanting than that. It was ephemeral. It was just beautiful to see this changing, dancing, misty lights of green, and we got some purples and some orange, and extraordinary. And I took photographs, and they danced for hours, and it repeated itself for the next few nights, and we were just so incredibly so lucky. It was an incredible experience.
And really, were you sleeping outdoors, or did you?
We were sleeping in one of the traditional tents, so a big domed shaped tent, and sleeping under rainbow skins. So we were sleeping on wooden trestles underneath the rainbow skins, and there was a fire in the middle of the tent, and we did our cooking on the fire, and that's what kept us warm during the night. Absolutely extraordinary.
Oh, that sounds like an incredibly magical experience, Tina. Oh my goodness, I would love to do that.
And I would absolutely recommend it to anybody, because it didn't require great physical strength, you know, because we traveled by plane and then by bus, and then when we went out into the countryside, we were traveling on there were kind of little cars pulled by skis, by motor skis. So we were sitting down and brought out, and all our gear and everything was brought with us to the campsite. So, and then from the campsite, we used the campsite as a central focal point. And from there, we went during the day, and we went out on ski trips, and we were pulled by sled skis with the dogs, the huskies, and we had great fun. But you didn't need to be physically, you know, active. Strong, yeah. So whereas before I was stomping up mountains and things, this was actually quite anybody who had.
That sounds more like my sort of travel now. I could do that. I could do that for no bother at all.
We're covered up in furs, and it was just lovely, really. A very, very unique and wonderful experience.
Yeah. Tina, where would you tell your 18-year-old self to go?
I would actually tell my 18-year-old self, or any 18-year-old, to go and try a cruise. Because I always dismissed cruises because I thought they were for old people, until I brought my family, my mother and father, on one. And I suddenly realized that I was addicted. And I've been going on cruises ever since. And it's just extraordinary, because you're on, you know, you've got this beautiful hotel, this floating hotel, and you wake up in the morning in a different part of the world. And you get to make your shore excursions and find out about, you know, some lovely city or some new type of archaeology, or, you know, there's always something new and fascinating on the agenda. And then you go back to your wonderful hotel and you sail on to a new, out into the sunset and onto a new sunrise in some other part. And I think it was absolutely gorgeous. I love cruises now. And you make great friends, because you're sitting at the same table every night for however long your cruise is. And you get to find out about what other people got up to during the day. And I've even had a romance on a cruise.
Oh, lovely. I wouldn't have had you as a cruiser, Tina, with all your adventure. That's the complete opposite. But isn't it lovely that you can just enjoy different types of travel, just equally?
Absolutely, yeah. And as I say, I had kind of, I would have, you know, knocked it off the list for me when I was a teenager or a young lass in my 20s. I would have thought it was just for older people, but genuinely, no, it's something that's good for all ages.
Where is your favourite spot in Ireland? Or do you have a hidden or secret gem of a place to visit?
Lots of secret places in Ireland. I had a huge list of places, but if I was supposed to pick out a hidden one, perhaps, or one that isn't so well beaten a track, I'd say the Blasket Moor, or the Great Blasket, and the Silver Strand down in Kerry on the Great Blasket. So, and I think in particular, it would be a particular night that I spent down there, because I used to camp out quite a lot on the Great Blasket when I was a young'un. And
fabulous.
It was a particular night that I went skinny dipping.
Oh my god!
On the strand, and the seals were all sleeping along, and there was a beautiful moon out, and it was the time of year when you have this. I think it's phosphorescence, you call it, in the water.
It is. Oh, it's beautiful. The luminous little sea insects. Oh my god!
And they become illuminated with friction. So they caught along all the little hairs on my arms and legs and basically I shone like a fairy, like I lit up the lights. And then walking along the beach, your footprints are illuminated in the sand because the wet sand, your feet are pressing down through it. And it was just absolutely magical. Just an extraordinary experience, an out of world experience here in our own country.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I've only ever seen them in Thailand, actually, is where I saw them. I didn't see them in Ireland before. So that's absolutely, because it's only certain times of the year, isn't it?
Small little time
when you can actually see them. And I have to mention Lusty Beg here, because you're one of the few people I know who've been to Lusty Beg. And I think it's a great secret, a little hideaway on Lower Loch Earn. Up in Northern Ireland. It's a great spot.
Wonderful, absolutely wonderful. And we went up as a party from work. So there was a lot of us that went up, and we had an absolute ball. It looked after us so well. I mean, the food was amazing, the accommodation was incredible, but the fun was hilarious, and beautiful water and beautiful. There was adventure. Games to play, and there was just some fantastic scenery, and we got to do loads of different things, and we did some off-roading and lots of different adventures and some archery. And yeah, that is a hidden spot,
isn't it? You don't hear it very often. And you know, it's they're beautiful self-catering accommodation, and their spa is the cheapest spa I was ever in, and it was glorious, both for seaweed baths and for, you know, for the old waxing and things like that. It was like a quarter the price anywhere else I've been. It was, you know, maybe because it's in pounds as well, but I think the lovely idea of actually you have to when you get there, you have to cross that little small stretch of water, so you're on an island, and that is really.
It felt amazing. It really did. Talk about a getaway, you know, and it was only a couple of miles up the road from, a couple of hours, shall we say.
Absolutely. And that area in Ireland is so rich with the geopark and the beautiful, you know, the Stairway to Heaven walkway now through the, it's stunning.
I'm glad you reminded me about it, because I must put that on my list of places to go back and see as well now when the restrictions are lifted. Because there's so much going on up there, like, you know, and it would be a lovely base to actually go and see and do other things from as well.
Absolutely.
That was great fun, you know.
and what about on your travels, is there anything strange that you've eaten?
It might not sound strange, but it's a flashback to the mountains. I think the strangest thing, because it was out of context, was popcorn on Everest.
And
we had had a diet. Now, there were quite a few unusual things that I had eaten along the way, and I could name a few of them. Yeah, actually, probably that was... In terms of things that stood out from a culinary perspective, I'd say the whole trip to Everest was one, because I ate yak meat, which was interesting, and some of the climbers didn't want to. So that was interesting. But the popcorn was hilarious, because we had spent 3 weeks eating kind of a very simple stew of vegetables and eggs, because you can't take fresh meat with you, you know, when you're going through the heat and then into the ice. You're limited with what you can bring with you. So we had eaten a diet of stews of vegetables and eggs and things like that, and we'd eaten lots of porridge with yak butter added to it to give us energy. And so after this very restricted diet, it just seemed really strange that we were in a tea house on the way back down and they had popcorn. So we feasted on popcorn.
It was like a treat.
I'd ever tasted.
of course, when it's a treat like that, for goodness. But when it comes to hotels now, it sounds like you are a real adventurous traveler, Tina. Like, you really will go anywhere. But is there anything particular you like about hotels, or any special hotel you've been to that you'd like to tell us?
Well, you mentioned spas, and I love the spa experience. But strangely, I'm not into I'm not too keen on massage or facials. My friends can't understand this, because they reckon that it's one of the most blissful things of being alive is having a good massage.
Oh, well, now Elaine Crowley will tell you that there's nothing to beat it. That's her favourite.
I love spas, but not for the facials and not for the massage. I love it for, I love the scents of candles and the smells in the air, but it's the watery things that I love. I love the plunge pools. I love swimming pools. I love spas with the swimming pool. I'm very disappointed if I go to a spa and it doesn't have a swimming pool. So for me, it's all the watery things that goes on. But I think the strangest one that I ever went to was, again, in Russia, in the Caucasus. And I had brought a swimming costume with me because they, I had been told that there was going to be a spa at this hotel. And there was, but it was a plunge pool, a massive freezing cold plunge pool. And this was in a place in Shiget in Terskol. It's where the military billets for the KGB were originally during the Cold War. And this plunge pool was the large of it, it was as large as an ordinary swimming pool. But most people used it naked.
Oh, this is, I've had this conversation before on this podcast with people about you know our reluctance to remove our coverings, the Irish reluctance.
I wasn't quite brave enough to lose the swimsuit, but I wasn't often put by other people going in naked. But yeah, it was an extraordinary experience. And then you'd go into a sauna afterwards and hit yourself with birch sticks or whatever stick.
Get the circulation going. Yeah.
Sounds a bit weird out of context.
It does. Oh,
it was memorable.
Yeah, and you know, Russia is quite different. I've only been to St. Petersburg myself, but what struck you? I mean, obviously you've described perfectly the landscape, but is there anything else that struck you about Russia?
I found that one of the big things for me was that it really showed to me how little I knew about Russia, because, you know, I grew up in a world where we were coming out of the back of the Cold War and we were watching, our knowledge of Russia was really sort of
it's very limited. Yeah.
And I was taken by the contrast and of course, look, the immensity of the landmass itself, but the contrast between rich and poor. And I'd mentioned about traveling through the countryside, I was looking at shacks that were literally holes in fields with baked bean cans used as chimneys, to being in Moscow and being in a VIP party at the you know, in a hotel looking out over the whole of Moscow, and then down in the square and seeing, you know, people queuing and then seeing the richness of the wonderful shops and the stores and the malls and the jewelry.
So what was it like in the fancy hotel in Russia? Like, were you in near Red Square or?
No, we were actually in the equivalent of a travelodge in the outsides or the outskirts of Moscow, but we had gone into central Moscow to party as VIPs in one of the slinkier models. So that again in itself was a huge contrast. Because we were literally in this rooftop VIP restaurant type suite where we were, you know, was open to the nighttime, like it was rooftop, so obviously you could see the stars and you could see the whole of Moscow, and we had very, very beautiful people serving us wonderful drinks and nice snacks, and we just had the best of everything. But at the same time, we had the hotel advising us to get taxis organized from within the hotel and not to get taxis on the street. And there was this kind of an ominous vibe running through. We were only there for 24 hours, but it was just, again, it just seemed like so many different things going on. There was incredible wealth, incredible luxury. There was poverty. There was this feeling of danger as well. And it just felt absolutely intriguing to me. I'd love to go back. I'd love to spend more time there.
What year was that, Tina?
That would have been around 2010, I think. Yeah. 2010.
Yeah, it's more recently. It was more recently now. I was in St. Petersburg, but what struck me, we drove out into the countryside to go and see the Catherine Palace, you know, with the famous amber room. But what struck me was it was like loads of Ballymun Towers, if you remember what Ballymun Towers looked like. And and just masses and masses of open countryside that was obviously agricultural land, but just every town had no heart or centre or shops even. It was just stacks of Ballymun towers, and they weren't particularly well kept. And the tour guide said to us, you can tell, you know, the quality of the accommodation by the windows, on whether they're really old and single pane, or whether they've got, you know, double glazing, or they're kind of, you know, that's the only difference you can tell. And she just said everybody lived in these. And you know that idea of communism where, you know, everybody's equal, but some are more equal than others, you know, it's quite strange. And you it's only when you read books like, I think, Animal Farm by George Orwell, that you really get the idea, you know, it's very difficult to get a socialist society right, because
the imagery that you have about the you know, the high bills, that I also felt that you know, you would be driving through a village in the Caucasus on your way to nowhere, like, you know, literally traveling for hours by bus into the middle of this most barren countryside, beautiful but barren, and you'd come through this village of high-rise apartments, and it almost felt that you were looking at deserted buildings. But the guides that were with us assured us that people were actually still living in them, but they looked dilapidated and abandoned. Yeah. What kind of life?
It's quite depressing, and you know, that's what kind of makes you concerned when you see kind of developments in Dublin being discussed. You know, about especially this co-living, you know, these co-living places here. It's kind of tipping on that, and you kind of go, you know, there is plenty of land in the country, you know, like, why are we pushing people into high rise that way?
It's not our first flirtatious experience as well with intensive living in, because we had two vacant reports, and we went down the road even through the boom times of building high density housing, which now everybody agrees is a bad thing. So people need a bit of space, you know, and
I think we do. I like the sound of repopulating these small villages and towns, and maybe starting the grassroots businesses.
Yeah, the McVerry Trust have been doing great work in that regard, and it's certainly, I've read a few reports where they're looking at going into areas right across the country in towns where you have deserted buildings and buildings that have been fallen into disrepair, and they're doing the model of working on putting a commercial property into the bottom part and a residential property into the upper part of buildings, which would be such a win-win for villages and towns.
Absolutely. It's kind of like the old way we used to live, you know, the way you'd have the butcher lived above their shop, and you'd have the grocer lived above their shop, and the shoemaker even, you know, and the idea of, you know, small businesses getting away from feeding Amazon and all these large companies and that don't need it, you know, the idea.
The pandemic will actually, you know, change, you know, bring about some changes for the better, because I think we've all now learned that we don't have to be in a car going to work all the time, you know, and of course some businesses are more suited to that than others, but I hope some of the changes that have happened could become positive influences for the future, perhaps.
I hope so.
Yeah,
people absolutely.
Duty to a certain hour of every day, and then the exodus in the evening, you know.
You know, and you know, I quite like the idea of old fashioned travel, romantic travel on trains, and taking the actual journey as a part of your trip. Do you remember the way, like, they did these grand tours in Victorian and Edwardian times? You know, young people, when they finished college, went off and they did their grand tours very slowly. We have interrailing now, I suppose, but the idea of, you know, instead of just hopping on a plane, actually getting a boat and experiencing traveling with the sun, you know, rather than just being living there instantaneously. Yeah.
You know, that's one of the things when you come back from, and when you say grand tour, it kind of rings a bell for me, but when you come back from an adventure where you've been away out of your normal mind space for a number of weeks, you get this feeling that, you know, you suddenly realize that life is for living, and that we spend so much time trying to rush to be in work, to rush to achieve, to rush to make an income, to rush to build a house, to rush to have a family. We're rushing to this end point, which is death.
Yes.
Instead of sitting back and relaxing and enjoying what we have.
I couldn't agree more. You know, life is a journey, and it is like we're on a train, you know, and everything we do. And as you say, like, we don't put off if an opportunity comes up. And I said yes to a lot of things that were very awkward for me to attend at the time, because of my family life and what was going on with my work and everything. But I tended to say yes. And boy, am I glad I did now. Things like going to space camp in Bad Alabama, you know, and crashing a shuttle into the moon. because, you know, but experimenting and making a rocket and learning about the space race. I mean, my God, that blew my mind. The idea that after the end of the Second World War, it's kind of like the Americans and the Russians just carved up the Nazi scientists. And the Russians brought them east and the Americans brought them west. And that was the start of the Cold War, the space race. So it was really, you know, the German great scientific minds that they used. You know, how many people think of that when they look back at their James Bond movies about the Cold War, you know, about East versus West and all that. So I always think travel, there's nothing greater than going to a very different space to actually see the world with new eyes, you know. And then this is why it's so important that we keep it alive and talk about it and get back there, you know.
Yeah, it's educational, it's life-changing, it takes a pause, it allows you to get out of your box and look back in at yourself. And I think that that's an important thing for all of us to be able to do.
Yeah. So what's top of your bucket list, Tina, then, once we get out of here, once we can move again?
First of all, I want to go to Villefranche and to sit on the beach and to swim in the sea, possibly 21 degrees.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Maybe be rescued by more French fishermen. That's number one. Number two is back here at home. I want to get fit enough to be able to do our own beautiful, fantastic mountains here at home, and particularly down to my lovely Karen Toole, and to be able to do her again. And the third thing is Machu Picchu. That's definitely not going to escape me in the time ahead. I really, really want to do Machu Picchu. Yeah, so it's a 1, 2, 3 on that.
So what were you working on then at the moment? What are your is there anything else that you're involved in? You know, as I said, you've done great charity work. Would you like to just say the charity?
Well, I'm full time carer now for Dad. So that takes up most of my time. Dad's 95, and he suffers from dementia. And I advocate for the Irish Alzheimer's Society. And I have accidentally, over the course of the past year, found myself more and more speaking about family carers. So they've had a very tough year. I don't want to mention the war, but we weren't included on the vaccination list, the priority list. And we took it all very badly because we felt very exposed. Not that we wanted ourselves to be sort of safe, but it was because if we get sick, the people that we're looking after.
Yeah.
So it's led to sort of a year of me talking about that. But unfortunately, that hasn't changed. So we'll see the way that the rest of the year pans out in terms of getting vaccines. I'm fortunate enough now that my lovely dad has had both of his Pfizer vaccines. So in 1 week's time, he'll be fully protected, which is a huge weight off my mind. So along with that, I write, I do some shifts for News Talk and Today FM, who've been wonderful to me. My radio family have allowed me to freelance around my family carer needs, which is wonderful because it still keeps me current and keeps me engaged in the workplace. And it's, you know, it's, I think, very important for me to be able to do that. And I also I write for a number of websites that look at family carers, but also look at dementia and also look at aging and talk about stories that brings carers together and hopefully shares experiences. So I'm quite busy. quite busy. Oh, yeah. And
you're a voice for others, you know, and I think it's really, it's great what you're doing. And people can actually find out about you on your website, tinagates.com. Is that right?
I'm basically on everything, you know, as Tina Gates. So I'm on LinkedIn, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, I have a website, I'm all over the place. But yeah, put Tina Gates into Google and you'll find me somewhere.
How can someone listening help? Is there somewhere they can donate to really make a difference, to give respite to carers?
It's not really a case of donating. It's really a case of pressurising our government when it comes to the next election to realise that carers really can't be taken for granted forever. I mean, one common experience that has come across my desk and come to me with lots of people contacting me over the past 12 months is that it seems like every wave, every generation of carers comes up against the same wall. And we all find that there's a lack of diagnosis for the people that we're looking after. There's a lack of supports or a lack of access to supports. There are supports available, but it's hard to find out about them. And then it's hard to achieve them. Even looking for a carer's allowance takes 12 to 16 weeks to process, during which time you have no idea that you're going to actually get it or not. And you're spinning out. You're not understanding what you're going to do or how you're going to manage. So everything's really, really very difficult. And each generation and each new set of carers is falling into exactly the same set of problems.
I think that's something to strive for, Tina, and as a great work you're doing. And listen, thank you so much for talking to me today. I've really, really enjoyed it. I feel like I've been in amazing, unusual places. You brought me back to Africa, which I absolutely adore, and I've set the challenge. I'm definitely going to aim for Kilimanjaro once we can do large scale adventure bucket list trips like that again.
And well, thank you. I've absolutely feel as if we've traveled the world together. It's a really, really nice thing to do.
Isn't it lovely? And it's still there, and the world isn't going anywhere, and it's there for us. We just need to make sure that we are allowed to travel, and we do have to stand up for our constitutional rights. That's another thing. But I think as journalists, we can't let that slip either. You know, I think it's very important.
Very important
that we come out the other end of this pandemic with the same freedoms that we had. We don't have them taken away from us. I think that's something, you know, equally important.
Hugely important, and something that we need to keep a very close eye on in the months.
Yeah,
and years.
I mean, a lot of what the conspiracy theorists were banging on about a year ago are actually now mainstream news, and that's actually quite scary. And it's something that I think it's worth people keeping an eye on it, especially any changes to the constitution that are made, you know, under the guise of the pandemic, but are actually will change how we can actually
longer
live.
Reach. We need to make sure that their sunset is.
I think that's it. But that's probably another conversation for another day, Tina. But listen, thanks so much again. And I look forward to seeing you in the Elaine studio when we're all back in the studio.
That'll be wonderful. I really look forward to that too.
Yeah. Great, Tina. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye now.
Well, it was lovely to take time out to talk to Tina. She's one of the nicest people I've met on my broadcasting travels. And I've certainly been travelling for the last 8 years. So in a way, I've enjoyed having time to reflect on these over the last year. I spent, in fact, the latter part of it editing and crafting my book, Journey to the Heartland. And writing a book is a personal journey that, as authors, we take alone. And while you're in a book contract, it can feel similar to running on a hamster wheel with frenzied attempts to be more inspiring and better and stronger than your last book. So I had stepped off that hamster wheel in 2013 after completing 6 books in 6 years, and I was truly exhausted. So it wasn't intentional to reinvent myself as a travel writer, but my wanderlust and the opportunity to write for travel drew me away from the world of books. I've been writing features and articles for newspapers and magazines all over the world. And I've been writing for Irish newspapers and magazines and international ones. And it's great to give snapshots of different cultures and events that I took and experienced on my travels. I was transported with each trip that I took, whether it was to a new state in America or a new country in Asia, or the joy of ticking off, you know, major trips like visiting Machu Picchu from my long bucket list. I mean, I feel very privileged to have traveled so much. But at the back of my mind was the knowledge that with this well-spent time, I would be able to some stage use my travels to inspire and maybe write a book. More often than not, while I was on my travels, I brought one or both of my children. And I did this to broaden their minds and teach them about life and culture in a way that can't be compared to any other sort of learning that they may do in the classroom. We've made funny poses on the Great Wall of China, and we've kayaked through Hongs in Thailand. And we even got a fit of the giggles in the Amber Room in the Katrin Palace in St. Petersburg, places that I've mentioned in my chat earlier with Tina today. But travel writing has taken me and shown me really the wonders of the world. And some highlights I do have to mention include safaris to Tanzania and South Africa. And I actually experienced Mardi Gras in Mobile in Alabama, which is actually the first Mardi Gras, even older than New Orleans. One of the most remarkable things I did do was attend the Kentucky Derby. It was actually extremely wet and rainy, one of the most unsuccessful Kentucky Derbies. But that was a remarkable display of just culture and excitement. And, you know, whether we agree with these events or not, they are part of what makes us who we are as society. But it did take a pandemic to stop me in my tracks and make me evaluate all that I've seen and all that is great in this world and what it has to offer. And indeed, I love quoting from Mark Twain, because I really think he sums it all up when he says, "Travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry and narrow-mindedness. Broad, wholesome, charitable views of men and things cannot be acquired by vegetating in one little corner of the earth all one's lifetime." And I think we've been feeling seriously lost, those of us who love travel especially, being under really like a form of house arrest during the pandemic and not being allowed to move and to see and to touch and to really experience the world. So hopefully this will all change as the year progresses. But one of my pivotal adventures in my memory was taken in 2014 when I set off on a road trip through Oklahoma with my father. I packed a copy of Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath in my suitcase to help inspire me. And it's something that I have done on my travels. For example, I've taken Ernest Hemingway to Cuba with me and taken Dylan Thomas to Wales. So I have found that doing this really helps me understand someone else's point of view of the place I'm visiting. And I found in Oklahoma a state that is filled with really warm country folk who are eager to lend you a helping hand and give guidance, and that life is quite simple there and has been complicated by a world that is dominated by big corporations dictating the future. You know, we stayed on a working ranch and we saw the care and passion that these people gave as they tended to their cattle, and yet how restricted they were with what they could do with their cattle. They weren't allowed to have them organic. They had to inject antibiotics into them. And a lot of the farmland was being, you know, hoovered up by large corporations in America, which is something that's quite dangerous that's happening. So I actually saw great similarities between the evolution of how the Great Depression came about and the warning signs of where the US was progressing in 2014. And I was overwhelmed by the stories of the Native Americans and the decimation of their land and cultures. And yet I felt they still have so much wisdom to share. So, like, I had my father with me on this trip, and he is an incredibly wise countryman who grew up on a farm. And I saw lots of similarities between the way of life in the middle of America and the way our forefathers, you know, earned a living on the land in Ireland. So with all these thoughts in my head, I knew that I had the seeds of a novel germinating away there. And I did start the novel in 2016 and had the name Journey to the Heartland for it. But I tried desperately to find inside myself what I was writing about, and the novel just didn't come about. But I found that as time had passed, 2020 was actually the zeitgeist, and time to dust down my novel and reflect on how the world had changed. During the pandemic was the perfect time to reassess and conclude the book. So America's heartlands and the states in the Midwest stretching across the continent, you know, they conjure up a way of life that is fast disappearing. And as we have had to look inside ourselves during this period of introspection and isolation with the COVID crisis, global crisis, I've assessed how much of the past needs to remain and the importance of learning from our elders. Because although Journey to the Heartland is a story of love and all that makes us human and connected, there is a big dollop of spirituality thrown in. And I think in a post-COVID sanitized world, I would hate to see the disappearance of spirituality, because I think it's more important than ever now to reach into our hearts and connect to our spirits. This is part of the message conveyed by my lead character in the novel, who is a fountain of wisdom and common sense. And he's actually visually impaired, but despite that, he does say that he has other senses have heightened since he loses his sight. So as an author, I've always been amazed at the cycles in history. And in the words of the German philosopher Hegel, my favourite quote is, "The only thing we learn from history is that we don't learn from history." And I think now is a time when we're living in that it's more important than ever to learn from history. Watch what happened in previous pandemics. Watch what happened previous times when there was, you know, a suppression of human rights. Watch, you know, how the world changes because of large scale events, and make sure that we don't repeat mistakes. So with this melting pot of ideas, I crafted Journey to the Heartland, and I have given, I hope, readers much to discuss. It was actually chosen for the Hope Foundation Book Club for March in Cork, and I met the lovely people involved in that. And, you know, the Hope Foundation is a wonderful charity that I would recommend people look up and try and help support, because they help the street people, the poorest of the poor in Calcutta, in India. And they make a real difference to people's lives. I'm also available for book clubs if anybody listening is in a book club and they would like to get in touch. You can visit me via my website, thenoveltraveller.com, or on michellewalshjackson.com. And what I'll do is I can provide you with the books and come along and visit by Zoom. It's a great way now for people to connect, and hopefully the book will bring pleasure to people who enjoy reading about America and about spiritual ideas and philosophies, because there's a lot of philosophy in the book. So it's published by thenovelpress.com. You can buy it from Kenny's Bookshop. And having written for the Irish Times Business for several years, I realised that it's more important than ever now to support Irish businesses. So whether it's the Book Centre or Kenny's or, you know, your local bookshop, we can't all download from Amazon, and we need to look after our homegrown industries. So that's why I'm actively promoting buying Irish and local now more than ever. So finally, I'd like to thank you for listening to my podcast each week. And if you missed a week, do listen back to an episode that might inspire some of your own novel travels. And I'll still be on The Elaine Show on Virgin Media every Tuesday, well, every second Tuesday. And you can listen out for me on The Hard Shoulder on News Talk 2, as I'll be back on the airwaves weekly in May. So ciao for now, and thanks for listening. And I'm going to leave you, as always, with this gorgeous piece of music from Pat Coldrick. Do check out his album, Kayando, and it's Oreo Sunrise. So as I'll say, ciao for now.
you want a better tomorrow, start heading for it today with Toyota's incredible range of self-charging hybrid electric cars, including the eye-catching CHR and the RAV4. With contributions of up to €3,000, join the thousands of hybrid drivers who have made Toyota Ireland's best-selling car brand in 2021. Contact your dealer or try out our virtual tools at toyota.ie and start your electric journey today. Toyota, built for a better world. Terms and conditions apply. Claim applies up to March 2021.